It's time for Firearm Friday, a podcast dedicated to bringing together the firearm industry and community. Now here's your host, from the great state of Texas, the tactical leprechaun himself, Chris Dover.
Welcome to Firearm Friday. I am indeed Chris Dover, and today we're going to be talking with Mark Dye. Mark is the director of the gunsmithing program there at Montgomery Community College, which is in North Carolina. If you're interested, then you can certainly check that out at montgomery.edu. But first, let's talk a quick minute about Gear Report. Now, Gear Report is a website devoted to the review of firearm and outdoor related gear. So if you're in the market for a particular item and you're looking for some honest, well-written, good reviews on that item to help you make a decision in your purchase, then jump over and see if there's anything over on Gear Report that might help you out. That address is gear-report.com. Okay, we've got Mark with us, and again, Mark is the director of the gunsmithing program there at Montgomery Community College. That's North Carolina, correct, Mark?
Absolutely. We're in Troy, North Carolina, the central part of the state, about an hour east of Charlotte or an hour south of Greensboro, North Carolina.
Okay, very good.
Good to be on here with you, Chris.
I really appreciate you taking the time. It was interesting kind of bumping into you. I was actually on the way to find the AGI booth, which I'm sure you're familiar with those guys, and just kind of run across, happened to see you guys there, and I thought, okay, well, this kind of fits what I'm looking for, because really wanted to get somebody in here. I know a bunch of people locally in the community that have went through various gunsmithing programs, and then out there in these live chats and online and social media, that's a question that gets asked here and there, is about gunsmithing programs and where do you go and what do you do and what do they actually teach you, and there's a lot of intricacies, it seems like, with the various programs. So I think it's going to be an interesting conversation, to say the least. But what I would like to start out talking about, if you don't mind, before we get into the program there at Montgomery Community College, is a little bit about you. What's your background with your firearm history, firearm background, leading up and going into becoming the director of the gunsmithing program there?
All right. Well, like a lot of people, I've been a lifelong firearm enthusiast. I can't ever remember not being a gun guy. Mm-hmm. I learned to read out of gun magazines. My grandfather saved all of his old American Riflemen so that I could read them and keep up with that sort of thing. By the time I was 10 years old, I was reading probably 3 hours a day of just gun stuff. So I knew that I wanted to do something with firearms. When I was probably about 15, I met a guy who was a gunsmith, an older guy, and he gave me the two best pieces of advice about becoming a gunsmith that I've ever gotten from anybody. And the first one was, you're still young, go to law school instead. And the second piece of advice was that if you're interested, go take a machining course at your local community college or your Votech school. And if you like it, then you can go to a gunsmithing school and pursue that. And if you don't like it, find something else to do. And that turned out to be really good advice. I took a couple years of machining at a Votech school. And then in 96, I came here to Montgomery as a student. So I came here and did the two-year program. At the end of that 2 years, in 98, I went to work for Clark Custom Guns in Shreveport, Louisiana. So I was mainly a 1911 guy there. I did some other things as well. Took up competitive shooting. I'm a USPSA shooter. So I've been shooting USPSA pretty seriously since 1999, probably. So I got to be around a lot of really cool people there. Jerry Michalek, Kay Michalek, Jim Clark Jr., met a lot of really neat people, Bruce Pyatt, just fantastic people in the industry. Got my feet wet, got a lot of good experience there. Early 2003, I went to work at Bowen Classic Arms in Louisville, Tennessee. So I did revolver work there. I was mainly a Smith & Wesson tuner, but I did a lot of other stuff on Ruger Blackhawks and Ruger Redhawks and that sort of thing, so mainly revolver stuff. So at the same time I was there, I also continued building 1911s and 2011s on the side, had a little business, Die Custom, that I ran for a while. So I was there for about 8.5, going on 9 years. And then I got a call from one of my former instructors here at Montgomery, Wayne Bernauer, who was at the program for 30 years, asking me if I was interested in applying for a position as an instructor. So I was at a good point to do that. I had kind of reached a point where I needed to make a decision between going out full-time on my own with my small business or finding something else to do. I was about to get married and had some other life stuff going on, and it made a lot of sense to come here. So I came on in 2011 as an instructor, and didn't realize it at the time that I was being groomed to be the program director when Wayne Bernauer retired. So he retired about 4.5 years ago now, and so I've been here eight full years, and the director for four of them.
Now, did you know Wayne prior to that job offer?
Oh yeah, he was one of my instructors here. So he, you know, we had some experience there, and we kind of became friends. He was sort of a friend and mentor, and you know, we kept in touch and spoke several times a year during the 13 years that I was out working in the industry after I left here as a student.
Right.
But yeah, we were still good friends, and we still are today. Actually, I think I'll meet him for lunch today.
Right. That's interesting. I mean, it seems like he's seen something in you, right?
Well, I like to think that. You know, he told a story at his retirement ceremony that I told him when I was 18 years old that I was going to come and take his job one day. I don't remember that conversation, but it sure sounded funny when he told it at the retirement ceremony.
Right, right.
Be careful what you wish for.
Right, apparently. Now, a couple of follow-ups on, you know, the history going into that. It's interesting how you say you started out, because I'm the same way. People... One of the questions that gets thrown around and asks a lot is, you know, when was the first time you went shooting? What was the first, you know, firearm that you shot? And sadly, I envy people sometimes that start shooting in their 20s or something, because they remember that. I don't. I know I've got vague memories of early, you know, things that happened early. I mean, I know that they were one of the first that I shot or something like that. But that all kind of started with my grandfather, which has been dead and gone for quite a few years now, that he would be able probably to fill in that gap and tell me for sure what was the first. But I've been around it sort of like you so much that I don't actually remember. I couldn't say for sure. But with working on, you know, or quote-unquote gunsmithing on your first firearm, were you doing those sorts of things before you went into the program? Was that something that interested you?
Sure, to a limited degree. I'm a tinkerer, just like anybody that has sort of a mechanical mind. So, yeah, I remember trying to install a set of sling swivels and a recoil pad on a rifle that I bought when I was 13 or 14 years old. Mm-hmm. Just because it needed to be done, and I didn't know anybody else to do it. So they were probably pretty amateurish, but, you know, it was something that I had to try to do.
Yeah, and that's a pretty good project for a 13- or 14-year-old to take on, too. Yeah, for sure. Now, with the competitive shooting, growing up around anything, any hunting in there?
Yeah, absolutely. So all of my early exposure to firearms was about hunting. My dad wasn't a gun person at all. My grandfather was, and he sort of was my introduction. So he was a hunter. He had some rifles and shotguns that he hunted with. He didn't own, I don't even know if he owned a handgun at all. Mm-hmm. So especially deer hunting was sort of my early exposure to firearms. And I remember sort of in my late teens running across someone who had done some PPC handgun competition and talking about how much more difficult it was to shoot a handgun well than a rifle. So that sort of piqued my interest, and I thought, well, okay, if it's that much harder, that's the one I want to learn. Mm-hmm. So I remember my first handgun I bought, from a sheriff's deputy when I was 18 or something, I think. I bought a Smith & Wesson Model 13, and I went to a local PPC match. And I had no idea what was going on or what to do. But I just let some other people walk me through it and had a great time. And then my interest in competing sort of grew from there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, all of my early interest was about hunting. And when I came to gunsmithing school, my plan was to be a custom rifle builder. I wanted to learn to make fancy wood stocks and do nice wood checkering and very artistic sort of stuff. And I realized pretty quickly that I'm not much of an artist, but I'm a pretty good mechanic. So, I sort of gravitated more toward the mechanical side, and that's worked out pretty well for me.
Right, and that seems a really big niche market. I know people that do that, and it's really reliant, it seems like, on those repeat customers. Those doctors and lawyers, people that make a very good living. And want that $5,000 rifle, whatever it might be, for this one big hunt that they go on their entire life, and that type of thing. So you don't have the day-to-day with installing sights, or this thing's got a fail to feed, those type of nitpicky issues that the phrase common man runs into with their firearms. So it can be it may have been a blessing in the end for you.
Well, there are all sorts of different genres of gunsmithing and different specialties that people find along the way, some of it on purpose and some of it by accident. But it seems to me that most of the people that I know in the business that have done really well or made a good living at it have found some way to specialize. It's just difficult to be a general gunsmith and know all the things that you need to know and have all the parts that you need to have on hand to do really well at that. Mm-hmm. So I tend to encourage students to specialize at some point if they can find something that they're passionate about, that they really like, and can find a market for.
Mm-hmm. Now, is that part of, I'd certainly want to get into the curriculum and your role as director and some stuff like that, but just a quick follow-up. I've got it written down, but if I don't ask, I'll forget it. Career path, I guess, is what we're talking about, utilizing... The kid, the person, whatever, coming out of that gunsmithing program, or maybe even going in, is that something that's talked about? Is that a part of the curriculum in the program, talking about the different facets of gunsmithing that one can do?
Sure. Yeah, we actually touch on that quite a bit, a lot through casual conversation between instructors and students, as much as part of the actual curriculum. Our curriculum is sort of geared toward a general purpose education, sort of like a high school education in gunsmithing. So a little machining, a little stock work, a fair amount of rifle work. We probably gravitate more toward that than anything else. A little bit of handgun stuff, some metal finishing, Cerakoting. And then, of course, now we're doing a lot more with modern sporting firearms than we used to. So we really don't know a student coming in, and they probably don't know what sort of specialty they're interested in or what they might want to do. We do occasionally have some students that, I only want to be a custom rifle builder. I don't care about handguns. I don't care about any of those other things. And sometimes that works out for them and sometimes not, but we do tend to talk a lot about, this gunsmith that we know that works in such and such a place has done really well in this specialty. And I think that's a great option for somebody coming into the business to move toward. Mm-hmm. So we try to make our program geared toward things that guys can actually leave here and make a living doing.
Right. Yeah, because that's one of the things nowadays, not to get to go off into all the political, I guess, or anything like that, but one of the things nowadays is everybody needs to go to college, right? And even if it's a since everybody needs to go to college, you've got these folks that go and they don't really know what they want to do. They don't really have a career path or anything in mind, and they go for whatever, medieval French literature studies or something, and then they get out, and what are you going to do with that? It's worthless. So, I guess it works the same way, even if you're looking at going to something like a gunsmithing program, it's a good idea to at least some point, probably before you finish, have some type of an idea, because correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that would allow you to recognize and maybe what would be the word, recognize and emphasize on certain aspects of the program itself that's beneficial to that career choice you've made. Pay a little more attention during, you know, during that time, and be a little more involved, and maybe do a little extra credit and stuff like that.
Sure. Well, you've touched on something that's a real soapbox issue for me with, you know, talking about four-year schools. I mean, I certainly in favor of education of all sorts, but, you know, I'm 41, and I think anybody probably from the age of 50 down when they were in school was sold a bill of goods that go to college, get a degree, any degree will do, it doesn't matter what it is, and life will be good for you. You'll they really sold, at least when I was in school, they sold vocational education as something that the dumb kids do. You know, you're an intelligent guy, you need to go to the college prep classes. I had a very difficult time getting him to let me take machining during high school because they wanted to automatically enroll me in some other classes. And they've sold that bill of goods to students, and they've told people that skilled labor is beneath them. And now we're getting a sort of a reversal of what we've had over other generations, where skilled labor is in such short supply and the demand is high that a good welder or a good tool and die maker or something like that can really name their price. And some of these careers are, tool and die making is a perfect example. All of the guys that are good tool and die makers are 60 years old and they're getting ready to retire, and we're not training new ones. We're not replacing those people. And I feel like we're going to really have a problem in this country and probably other places in the world too once that begins to happen. So, you know, that's one thing that I'm really proud about doing vocational training at a community college, is that I feel like I'm really helping people gain real skills that may help them better themselves and better their life.
You know, you hit on something earlier, and then something you said just now, you know, made me think of a friend of mine. He's the same way. He's actually a machinist by trade, and he's one of the best gunsmiths that I know. And I think it's simply that machinist background and his capability to, he runs old lathe, he's got an older model lathe that's not CNC or anything like that, older model mill as well. And he's just amazing to watch him work. I can walk in there with a project or, you know, anything for some firearm I've got. You know, I need a little part. I need a part reproduced. I need, you know, you know, I'm looking to, hey, you know, working on a new design for a Form 1 suppressor or whatever. And, you know, he can sit down, draw stuff out, bang stuff out. It's just amazing. And not rely, nothing is computerized, right? And, you know, I've tried to soak up as much knowledge as I can from the guy over the years. But unfortunately, he's forgotten far more than I'll ever know. So you're absolutely right. First of all, when you were talking about getting into the machining side of things, as that, I'm sure we'll get into that later, but that's a very big aspect of it. But then also about the dying art, you know, of some of those. There's guys out there that, man, they're just so good at what they do, and there just doesn't seem to be anybody on the horizon to take their place.
Sure. Yeah, we've stressed computer, which is great, because there are a lot of technological jobs out there. There are a lot of things that need to be done. But there are also a lot of manual skills that still need to be done as well, or a blend of manual skills coupled with computerized training. And machining would be a perfect example there for someone who understands both manual machining and CNC together. That's a real opportunity.
Right. Now, with being the director of the program there, what all does that entail? How does that differ? What does that entail, and how does that differ from being an actual instructor?
Well, I teach as well. I still teach the same schedule that I did before I was the director. They just added a bunch of other stuff to me as well. So I advise the students on their path through school, so their class loads and that sort of thing. I also have a certain measure of control in designing the program or arranging the courses. For instance, we removed a stock making class that really wasn't relevant anymore, and just wrote a new handgun class that we're introducing into the program. So I wrote the curriculum, I'll be writing the syllabus for that and starting that class in the fall. So those sorts of things, decisions about equipment, about how the facilities are going to be arranged and maintained, and I supervise all the other instructors.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now, on that stock class, why is that not relevant anymore?
Well, we were probably the last gunsmithing school, except for maybe Pennsylvania, that was still doing a one-piece rifle stock from a blank. So we just started off with a big chunk of wood and whittled a stock out of it.
Right.
And I think that's a fabulous thing to learn how to do. There's a tremendous amount of knowledge to be gained from doing that. Mm-hmm. However, I think that is something that, you know, even professional stock makers don't make stocks that way anymore. They pull a stock off of a duplicator that's already got the rough shape of the stock that they can finish inletting and then a little bit of final shaping.
Right.
So whittling a stock from a blank is really something that nobody does anymore in the industry. And I felt like since probably 60% of the guns that come across the counter in an ordinary gunsmithing shop are handguns, that an additional handgun class was probably more beneficial to our students.
Yeah, I can see the only reason that would come into play is if a student went into the true custom build sector, sure, you know, rifle sector, and maybe somebody wanted an exotic wood of some sort. You know, I guess that might come into play, but I think you're right. Other than that,
feel like the skills learned during that class were really important. That's one of those classes that students typically hate, mm-hmm, but then 5 or 10 years down the road, they start to see the value of what they learned.
Now, how is that taught? I mean, is that taught on? Because I'm ignorant to that. I mean, was that class taught? Did you utilize a wood lathe or
the stock class? That one was mainly with a rasp, a little bit of milling machine work, of the basic inletting, but mainly a lot of elbow grease and a wood rasp.
Wow. Okay. Very cool. Yeah, so, you know, moving on with the, the curriculum. If you would, give us a quick overview of the curriculum with that, and then, I'm sure I'll have follow-ups from there.
Sure.
There'll be certain things we can hit on.
Well, our first semester, when a student first starts, they do nothing but machining. It's just a very intensive crash course in machining. You know, obviously, someone can't learn to be a real machinist in one semester, but we do what we can with trying to get the basics of lathe and mill and grinder operations so that we can get them, move them on to other machining operations that they'll do on firearms. So they really don't touch a firearm for the whole first semester they're here. And then they move into their second semester will be rifle threading and chambering and a basic repair class. So we actually start getting them working on guns. So they're threading and chambering custom rifle barrels and starting to take things apart, put them back together, and do the mechanical side of things. Mm-hmm. So our program is 2 full years, so they have to go through the summers as well. So the first summer, of first year, they do what we call our current gunsmithing techniques class. And that amounts to inletting some of the barreled actions that they've made during the threading and chambering class into stocks. So that way they can get them inlet into the stocks, they learn stock bedding, recoil pad installation, a little bit of stock finishing. But the important part of that is that at the end of that class, they've got shootable firearms. They can go down to the range, they can shoot them, and start to really see the results of why they spent so much time on that threading and chambering, why they had to go through all the steps that they did to try to make an accurate rifle. During the fall, they're moving into their second year now. So during that fall, they'll do, at least this year coming up, they'll do a handgun repair class, probably with me instructing that, and then they'll also do an advanced repair class, so more disassembly, reassembly, design and function theory. Something that's really near and dear to my heart is that I want students to understand how firearms work, what mechanical interactions have to take place inside the gun to make the magic happen. Mm-hmm. Because if you don't understand that and you're trying to make modifications or repairs, you're really putting band-aids on things rather than actually attacking the real problem. You might be treating the symptom rather than the disease. So then the spring of their second year, they'll do metal finishing. So they'll learn to polish and blue, do some parkerizing, some rust bluing, sort of an overview of different metal finishes. And they'll also do a custom handgun class. So the custom handgun class, a large portion of it will be building a custom 1911. So we do a kit gun there. You'll do some revolver barrel installations, some complex sight installations, cocking serrations, fancy lightning cuts on Glock slides, that sort of thing, RMR cuts, all the popular stuff now. Mm-hmm. And then moving into the final term, the summer of their second year, we've got a modern sporting firearms class. So they have to do AR stuff, and of course AR is sort of snapped together like Legos, so there's not a lot of real work to learn about that. So we try to up the ante a little bit there. We make them turn their own AR barrel from a blank, install their own barrel extension, drill their own gas porthole, contour the barrel, do all the work there so that they can actually learn those steps as well. We're also a little more now starting to get into some of the AK stuff because it's so popular.
Right. Wow. That's an interesting, I think that's an interesting concept, an interesting spin to put on the whole, you know, AR.
Well, we do a lot of alternate calibers too. So we do a lot of 6.5 Grendels and 6.5 Creedmoors and, you know, other calibers other than just 5.56 or 308.
Right.
You know, last year in the class that I ran, I had out of 12 or 13 guys in the class, I only had one guy that did a rifle length barrel. Everybody else wanted to do pistol length barrel with a brace on it because that's the cool thing to do now.
Right.
We had three or four 6.5 Grendels that were, you know, 10 or 12 inch barrels, which that's not my thing, but that's what the students wanted. And they actually worked out well and shot pretty well in the end.
Wow. Now with any of the custom rifles, that you're talking about, or the barrels with the ARs, or I guess even the 1911s that are built through the program, is there an odd caliber that, you know, once upon a time sticks out in your mind that somebody had to have, you know, had to do something in maybe a Wildcat or something strange?
Oh yeah. We always have students that want to do strange things. You know, it's a bandwagon thing. Once one guy in a class decides that he has to have something unusual, you know, I think we've got a 22 Cheetah Mark II Reamer here somewhere, you know, just really weird Wildcat stuff. But once one guy in a class decides they have to have it, there are usually going to be two or three others that'll pile on. But right now, the cool guy things everybody seems to want are everybody wants to do a 338 Lapua. Everybody's doing 6.5 Creedmoors. Those are the most normal calibers that everybody's jumping on. Everybody does a 308. But we also will have some guys that want to do safari rifles. So I think we're doing a 458 lot right now that one of the guys just finished up.
Wow.
So there's always somebody that wants to know what the biggest thing they can chamber is. So that's usually where they end up heading on that.
Right. Now with the coming right out of the gate with all the machining stuff, you know, I don't know. It seems like the way that's set up, that could be putting the overwhelming stuff first, in a way.
In a way, it does, and that's our number one predictor of student success in the program tends to be how well they do in machining class the first semester. Mm-hmm. That's our highest attrition. We lose more people after the end of the first semester than any other time. So one of my pushes right now is to try to encourage as many students as possible to take some machining before they enroll in the gunsmithing program, and we're trying to actually have that available to them on campus within the next year or two, that they can come take a machining class for a while they're on the waiting list for the gunsmithing program.
Well, then there's also potential apprenticeship, right, or internship or something with, you know, machinists that are out there or possibly existing gunsmiths or something like that, just to sort of kind of get their feet wet before they
absolutely
come in raw to your program.
I'm a firm believer that the more knowledge that a student shows up with, the more successful they can be.
Right. Now, along that lines, do you get students that have a little bit too much and they come in and you have that trouble to where they kind of buck the system, so to speak?
It depends on the student. You know, we've had some very good machinists here. But the interesting thing that I found is the ones that are the very best machinists are not a problem at all. They do their work. They may help another student occasionally, but they don't argue. They don't they don't bother us. Mm-hmm. The ones that seem to be the most trouble for that are the ones that have just a little bit of machining experience and really think they know a lot.
Right.
We had a guy that came through here probably 6 or 7 years ago that had been a machinist for General Motors in Northern Ohio for 35 years. He was in his 60s. And I mean, he was amazing. He taught me more about machining than I ever thought about teaching him.
Wow.
But never a problem. He had no ego about it. He came in, he did his work to perfection, and he moved on.
Right.
Whereas we've got some young guys that have gone through a tech school, sometimes they tend to be a little bit of a smart ass about it.
Right. Right. Now with the machining course, I guess backing up a little bit, about how many on average students do you have at any given time?
Right now we've got about 85 total students. We expanded our program at the beginning of 2017 to bring in some more. We had at one time a 3-year wait list to get into the program, and we expanded the program considerably. We built a second machine shop so we could bring in a whole other group of guys. So we currently have about 85. I think we had 94, 95 at the beginning of the fall semester, and we lost a few along the way. Our total capacity, if we had every class full all the time, I think we could actually run 105.
Wow, that's pretty significant. Now, what's the amount of instructors that you guys have available?
Right now we've got 5 full-time instructors, and we've got a part-time guy that teaches weekend classes, and then we've got 2 program assistants that are also sort of teaching assistants and general purpose, good man, man Friday kind of guys.
Now, are there instructors that are specialized? In other words, they handle just one specific portion of it, or is everybody kind of got that generalized education?
Well, it's interesting. All of us actually came through this program at one time or another.
Oh, okay.
Which is not by design. I've actually really tried hard to interview instructors that went through other schools, but we just haven't been able to find people that had the skills we needed. Mm-hmm. That they come through those other programs, not anything against the programs. Right. But we do have a little bit of specialization. I tend to be the handgun guy. Lynn Fagan, one of our other instructors, is our rifle guru. He's really, really crafty on threading and chambering and bolt rifle stuff. Matt Mutarelli, who's one of our instructors here, is really into flintlock rifles, period flintlock stuff. He teaches a lot of our repair classes and stock making stuff. Mm-hmm. But anything muzzleloader, he's our guy. Billy Athey, who's one of our instructors, our newest instructor actually, is a real whiz on doing Cerakote finishes. Mm-hmm. So we do specialize a little bit, but we also have to be well-rounded enough to teach any of the classes that happen to come up that we need an instructor for.
Right, yeah, you always have to pick up slack or answer off questions or something like that. So it sounds, you said y'all added a second facility, so that was going to be my next road to go down, was to ask, how big of a facility, what types of equipment do you guys have there available?
We have now about 25 lathes, about 11 or 12 per shop. We have 2 full machine shops. We've got about 15 full-size Bridgeport milling machines. We've got surface grinders. We've got all the horizontal bandsaws and vertical bandsaws, and we really have a very well equipped shop, and probably I would be willing to say we probably have the best equipped gunsmithing school as far as equipment in the United States.
Mm-hmm. And one heck of an electricity bill, it sounds like.
Yeah, absolutely. Luckily, I don't see that one. So.
Right. Wow. With that many, machines running, and probably a rather loud shop too, with all that stuff running.
It does get a little loud. It's not terrible, but yeah, it tends to be a little bit loud.
With the machining, I don't know. I mean, the machining stuff's always a fascination of mine because I love the idea of taking nothing and building something. A raw piece of material and seeing a part or something that's usable come from just a block of something. And I know that with one of the gunsmithing schools I'm familiar with locally here, which is also just a small community college, they actually go through with their machining and they build a lot of their own tools that they will need to work on firearms. Do you guys do anything like that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. The first semester of machining, that's what they issued a blueprint book, which has 35 or 40 blueprints, and they're all tools that they can use for gunsmithing later on. So we certainly encourage tool making and fixture making, because this is sort of a specialized industry. Not everything that you're ever going to need is going to be in Brownell's catalog. Mm-hmm. It's pretty common that you have to stop and make a tool to perform some function that you need to do. So since they have to learn how to make things anyway, why not have them make tools?
Right. And is there any CAD design? Is there anything like that incorporated into things with the with CNC and the computerized realm nowadays?
Only a little. We do have a CAD class. In order to get the associate degree, our students can earn a two-year associate degree. In order to get the associate, they have to take a computer class. And we've gotten it approved that they can take a CAD class for their computer requirement. We don't teach much CNC. We have one milling machine that has CNC capability, and we use it for a few things. But the way I tend to look at it is that CNC machining is its own two-year program. Wow. If we tried to incorporate it too much, number one, we would have to take away from a lot of the gunsmithing that we're currently teaching. Mm-hmm. And number two, we really wouldn't be doing CNC machining any justice. I really feel like that deserves its own specialized sector of training.
Right. Well, and this is a little bit off subject, I guess, in relationship to the topic of the gunsmithing school, but with the difference between, the manual and CNC machining, my take on this, and yours is going to be far more educated than mine, but my take on it is that it seems to me that CNC machining is more for mass production type stuff, whereas the manual is easier for like one-off things. And that's just coming from the buddy of mine that I talked about earlier. He's told me multiple times he can get on a mill or a lathe and he can bang out something if it's just a one-time thing. He can bang that out, way quicker than he can sit down and, design and do all of the stuff he's got to do to input into that CNC machine for just a one-off.
Yeah, in general, I would certainly agree with that. It's starting to change a little bit as CNC becomes cheaper and more prevalent, and as the CAD programs get better to be able to input designs into a CNC machine, or, the CAD CAM systems where you can use the CAM as a go-between. Mm-hmm. So that's starting to change a little bit as things get easier to do with a CNC machine. But for now, it's still the case, I think, that for one-off type stuff, you're still in manual machining, and for production, you're still in CNC. Mm-hmm. And a little bit would depend on the complexity of the parts you're making as well.
Right. Now, one thing that I haven't heard you mention, and I know is a big deal nowadays, so curious if it's part of the program or something that you've considered potentially for the future you'll have to add or something like that, and that's 3D printing.
We have a 3D printer here on campus. We use it for some of our CAD classes, so we've printed a few things that we've used in the program. One of them that's kind of interesting is our milling machines. The power feeds on them have a sacrificial plastic gear. It's supposed to tear up before the rest of the power feed if the table gets in a bind. Mm-hmm. So we go through those things like popcorn around here, because students that are new on machinery tend to tear things up.
Sure.
And so anyway, we've started printing those gears so that we can replace them a little quicker and easier than having to order new ones at $60 per. So that's kind of an interest, and it's certainly an interesting avenue in the firearms industry. I really see a huge market for 3D printing, especially prototyping in the firearms industry.
Yeah, exactly. Right.
With a friend of mine who worked for HK for a while was invited to the factory over in Germany to test some new handgun stuff that they were doing. And they had one of the metal 3D printers there, and they were printing handgun slides. They would go out on the range and shoot it a little bit. It would last a couple hundred rounds before it cracked. But it was a proof of concept sort of deal. They could go out and shoot it a little bit, make changes to the design, make suggestions, go eat lunch, come back, there'd be another slide printed. They could go out and shoot that one.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it really does help with that kind of stuff for sure. Yeah, you talked about the students breaking the machine. I can totally see how, you know, anytime you get new people on a piece of equipment, I mean, you can have that, right? I mean, look at
We bring in all these new guys that are brand new machinists. Yeah. The sort of the comparison I make, it's like having a whole bunch of brand new drivers driving your car.
Yeah, especially if you're talking about a manual transmission, and the next thing you know, you don't have a clutch.
Exactly, and that's a certain amount of that is just the nature of the beast. You know, obviously we want people to be as responsible and respectful with their equipment as possible. Mm-hmm. We try to really impress that on them, but you know, mistakes happen and things happen, and as long as people are honest and don't do anything malicious, that's okay as long as nobody gets hurt.
Right. Yeah. Now, when it's time to repair a machine or something like that, do the students have a part in that?
Not that much. Okay. We occasionally will have a student help us tear something down, but it is educational for them when they do that. But I tend to look at upkeep and maintenance sort of as our job. Not that long ago, all the instructors would just pitch in and roll up their sleeves and tear things down. Mm-hmm. And trust me, I'd much rather be tearing into a lathe than doing a spreadsheet. But unfortunately, my typing skills are getting a lot better than my wrench skills these days.
Right. Right.
But one of our program assistants, Tom Ault, that we hired, he's a graduate from here too. He's kind of taken on the role as being our millwright in house and fixing equipment, doing our maintenance.
Right. Now the firearms. It sounds like if you go through the 2-year program, I mean, you basically come out with at least 3 firearms, right?
Oh, well, yeah, usually more than that, because they have to thread and chamber 3 bolt action rifles. Mm. So they'll have at least those 3 custom rifles. They'll have a custom 1911. They'll have a Smith & Wesson revolver that they've done some barreling work on and tuning. And at least an AR-15 upper. We don't necessarily require them to purchase a lower, but they do have to build an upper. Mm-hmm. That they have to turn the barrel and do all the gas port work and everything with. Mm-hmm. So they'll at least have those firearms. And most of them, during the course of the program, purchase more firearms to do repairs and modifications and those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. We're really, really lucky here to have great relationships in the industry. We have a lot of companies that give our students fantastic deals. We do a lot of group purchases on things so that students don't have to go out and locate things on their own. We do Nighthawk gives us a great deal on 1911 kits.
Wow, that's a nice 1911 kit too.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of these barrel manufacturers, Schillen and Krieger and some of the others, mm-hmm. Have been amazing to help our students out and give them great deals on purchasing barrels. We do a group purchase through Remington usually for Model 700 actions, or through CZ to do the Model 550 actions.
Right.
So it's really nice to have those relationships in the industry to really help our students.
Right. And is that part of you guys going to these trade shows and stuff like that as well?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. My predecessor, Wayne Bernauer, he really started going to the SHOT Show back in the early 90s and really pounding the pavement there, talking to manufacturers, talking to people about our program. And I think it took him a long time to start getting some traction. But it really paid off in the end, and he established a blueprint there that we continue to follow. I'm at the NRA show. I'm at the SHOT show every year. I'm talking to people. I'm trying to push our program. But also the SHOT show in particular, we take students. This year, for instance, I took about 35 students to Vegas for the SHOT show. Mm-hmm. To really see what's out there in the industry. You know, people have very often a narrow view of what the industry is.
Oh, yeah.
Only been around deer hunting and quail hunting, and all of a sudden your eyes are open to all these other things that people are doing. It can really be an experience that changes the route that you might want to take in the industry. So we take a bunch of students and not only try to do things to help our program, but also to help the students learn more about the industry.
Well, that's a very cool thing that you do, I think, not only for the reasons that you talk about there, but the experience of SHOT Show is something that the average person doesn't get the opportunity to go through, because you have to be tied to the industry somehow. So, you know, being able to utilize, you know, being in that program, a part of the college and all that, to get in to then experience the especially the first time, the overwhelming experience of something like SHOT Show,
Yeah, absolutely.
Is pretty amazing. I think more gunsmithing programs and schools probably should consider that. I think that's a very good move.
Yeah, it's you know, my predecessor, he always thought that was a great selling point for the program too. We do a big raffle every year. We'll raffle off a dozen guns or so, and the students that sell enough raffle tickets will have their flight and their hotel paid for the SHOT Show trip, and they just have to figure out how to feed themselves while they're in Vegas.
Mm-hmm. Which is not a problem.
Which is not a problem. It can get expensive sometimes, but not a problem.
If you know the right places, you know, there's an awful lot of cheap buffets if you know the right places, you know.
Yeah, learn how to work your buffet ticket.
Right, exactly. Now, the curriculum as far as time, you talked earlier about a two-year associate's. Are there shorter specialized courses or different levels within that as well? I know here, and the reason I say that, I know with the one here, they've got a basic and intermediate and advanced. And I think if you add all three up, that it adds up to a couple of years worth of time. But you don't have to do each one. You have to do them consecutively, of course, but you don't have to do, you don't have to finish. I mean, you could go for whatever. You just want some basic stuff, then you just go for the basic, which is certain classes and certain curriculum. So how is all of that? Is it an all or nothing thing, or is it also broken up depending on what you want to do, or how does that work?
Well, we do issue certain certificates along the way. So if a student comes and completes, say, their first year without coming back for the second year, they do earn some certificates so that they're not leaving here with nothing. Currently, though, we are only really set up to bring students through in chronological order on the classes, and the classes sort of build on each other so that it works well that way.
Right.
We haven't done sort of a basic, intermediate, and advanced stair-step version. We've been asked a lot about that, but currently we haven't done it, and with our current student load, we probably won't be making that change. Sorry, I've got something in my throat there, but we do also offer a lot of short-term classes, which is one of the coolest things we do here. Mm-hmm. We do those, we advertise them through the NRA, so it's our NRA short-term gunsmithing program. But we've got a lot of one-week or two-week-long seminars that not only our regular students, but anyone can come and take. So you come and take a week-long class that's, you know, very intensive on, say, 1911 building, mm-hmm. or a basic lathe class if you just want to get a little bit of information about how to run a lathe. Mm-hmm. One of them that's been really popular the last few years is we do a suppressor build class where everybody has to file nice. A Form 1 with the ATF, and then they can come in and build their own suppressor on a lathe.
Nice. And that's not an altogether difficult process, depending on how you do it.
No, it's not at all. If you have a little bit of basic lathe knowledge, it's not that hard. You know, honestly, I've been saying for years that if it weren't for the National Firearms Act, we would be buying suppressors at Walmart for, $19.95.
Right. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've got one that I did, Form 1, for my 458 SOCOM. It was years ago, the 450 SOCOM, it just really came out, and I seen the subsonic capability of that, and I'm like, I need a suppressor. And so I got to looking around, and at that time, there was really only one company that even offered, I think it was Bowers at the time, that offered anything that they would remotely even say anything about 450, utilizing it for 458, and it was like $1,500. And then I got to looking around at, making some calls to some different companies about, custom building one and this, that, and the other. And they could do it for, $1,200 to $1,500, $1,800 and not guarantee any of the performance. And got to talking with that buddy of mine, and he's like, well, we just need to form one and build one. And I'm like, okay, let's do it, And, literally it was about $50 worth of material, the time was the big part. Of course, it's a washer style baffle system. It's not a monocore or anything like that. I can see where like the monocore stuff could get a little time involved. But then again, I'm you know, when it comes a lathe, I can work a lathe a little bit with a mill. Not so much. I'm not nearly as comfortable with a mill, especially if you're talking about banging out something like a monocore.
Sure. And you can make some of those designs really complex. And that's one place that I think metal 3D printing is really going to set the world on fire, because there are some really complex designs that are very difficult to machine, but you can do them through, you know, additive manufacturing, so through 3D printing, a lot more conveniently than you can take material away. So I think that's going to be a very interesting avenue for 3D printing.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, I don't know with that, you know, if you're talking about, you know, a BAPL system on a suppressor. You know, I've got to wonder of how, you know, how well, with current technology anyway, how well that it would hold up. But one would think that it would probably hold up fairly well, you know, even by today's standards.
Yeah, I would say fairly well. And it would depend some on the pressure levels you're...
Sure, I mean, if you're shooting some really, you know, high-powered stuff, you know, it's got to capture and regulate a lot of gas. That's going to be worse than shooting, like, you know, 22 subsonic or something like that, for example. You got to think shooting 22 subsonic, it'd last forever.
Yeah, and if you're trying to build a can to put on your 338 Lapua, obviously that's a lot different requirement. You've got a huge volume of gas and a lot of pressure to deal with. Your 458 SOCOM at subsonic levels is... you know, relatively small by comparison.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, we're getting close to time here, it looks like, but I've got, you know, we've got a hit on it, and I know that things change, but ballpark, about what does it cost for somebody to go through the program there?
Well, for in-state tuition for the 2 years, you're going to be at about $12,000. Mm-hmm. Out-of-state is about double that, and then what really gets kind of pricey for most of the students is the tools and materials, because our current tool list for, you know, just all the things you need to work on guns with is going to be about $10,000 to $12,000. I'd say $10,000 would be a minimum to get through the full 2 years. And a lot of students end up spending considerably more by the time they start wanting to buy, you know, upgraded materials and upgraded stocks and barrels and you know, better things. So they can spend considerably more than that. So it does get a little pricey in that respect. But they leave here with a full set of tools that they could go into business theoretically right then.
And do you know if you have students that go through on scholarship programs and stuff like that?
Absolutely. Yeah, we actually just distributed about $30,000 worth of scholarships to various students. We have a lot of scholarship opportunities. Mm-hmm. Most of them have some sort of help either via Pell Grant or through GI Bill or VA. Probably 60% of our students, or average of about 60% of our students, are former military.
Right.
So a good portion of those, or most of those, are using either GI Bill or VA to help fund their schooling.
And at any rate, like we mentioned before, I mean, it's you're looking at a fraction of the cost of a 4-year school for some silly, you know, liberal arts or, you know, dead language degree. It's not nearly as bad. I'll take the opportunity, because it's been something that, as far as at least my youngest child, I really wasn't involved with the older two enough to understand and benefit. But, you know, for those out there that may be listening that have kids and they show interest in something like this or whatever, you know, always got to, if we're talking about scholarships and stuff like that, I've got to talk about the 4-H programs across the country. There's, you know, not 4-H scholarships per se, although there are quite a few of those, but the doors that, you know, being in those 4-H programs, the doors that they open for additional scholarships outside the fray are absolutely amazing. So, anytime we talk about scholarships and stuff, I got to pimp that, because it's been such a blessing, I know, for us and the youngest daughter to get her. She went 4 years for accounting, had nothing to do with gunsmithing, but she actually has been considering going into work for actually a firearm manufacturer in their accounting department, which is close enough, I guess.
But, well, the world needs bean counters too.
Right, exactly. So, Mark, I appreciate you joining us this morning. It's been a great conversation. We've blown through our time pretty quick here, and would love to have you back in the future. Absolutely. We just kind of put this out there as well. We do a live version of this every second Friday for those that out there in the podcasting world and may be listening. So every second Friday at 10 Eastern over on the YouTube channel, we bring back a previous guest from these recorded podcasts and kind of put them in the hot seat with the live chat so that the audience out there has a chance to actually ask questions directly to our guests. So that may be something in the future, Mark. I've got to think that there's viewers out there, listeners out there, whatever, that could really flood those chat comments with questions for you and the whole gunsmithing school process and that sort of thing. So if you're game for that, we may bring you back for that as well one month.
Absolutely. Sounds like a blast.
And before we get out of here, if anybody wants more information on the gunsmithing program there at Montgomery Community College, do you guys have a website, someplace they can go and read up and look at everything?
Yep, it's just montgomery.edu.
Easy enough. Well, thank you very much, Mark. We appreciate it.
All right, thanks.
Thank you for joining in on another Firearm Friday. Don't forget to log on to clovertech.com. There you'll find our social media links, the blog, cool swag, and more. If you'd like to help support our projects and take advantage of some extra perks, you can do so over on Patreon at patreon.com/clovertech. Have a great weekend.